Chris Gibson, I know you're a colonel. I know you fought in wars. I know you know what it's like to be under fire. And I know the appreciation you have for veterans and for what they've gone through. We've talked about that before. But I want to ask you a question. You're not everybody's Republican. I mean, you know, you have, for example, properties. You're really opposed to international entanglements. I know that. I've heard you speak on this before. It's so easy to get into these things, isn't it?
Well, I think it is. And, you know, part of what I'm trying to bring to the discourse is a recognition that this has been a change in our country in about the past 50 years. Really, the legacy, although, you know, one could argue at that point, right, because the Marines involved in Central America, I certainly get all that, even dating back to the Philippines and the war with Spain. So I certainly acknowledge that this is a debatable point. But I think the essence of our country really can be described in the earliest days, a belief in freedom and in limited government that facilitated a life that was flourishing to God's given potential, and that would then eschew the entanglements. I mean, George Washington talked about this in his farewell address. He was concerned about the impact that even alliances would have in drawing us into long-standing conflicts and bleeding out the treasury and our souls and our country. And so there's this, you know, understanding at the founding that we were going to be a country that stood opposed to that, and that we would then, you know, certainly protect our cherished way of life, but we would respect that other countries might have differing opinions, and we would allow for them to fulfill their destiny in that regard. And what I think happened in the advent of the nuclear age, and really what became a bipartisan consensus to confront communism, that at the end of that period, you think of the wall coming down in 89, and then I think my belief is that what happened is this morphed into a belief that you would see democratic peace, and that if we were involved bringing that and expanding that, that would ultimately be a driver for economic flourishing form of life and peace. But it's really questionable, and I would argue that, you know, when we involve ourselves in all these military excursions, we create second-order effects that we don't fully understand.
For example?
Well, when you drop bombs, you know, I knew that this would be the case in Libya, that when you drop bombs, you're killing people and breaking things. And even if you say you're going there for humanitarian purposes, the physics of this, it rips through bodies and you kill people unintentionally. And that has a political effect in addition to the horrific human effect. And so what I'm trying to do is bring a consciousness to that, that I'm not saying that we should never go to war. I'm saying that our sole focus should be to protect our cherished way of life. And there are other ways to advance peace in the world through diplomacy, through the use of leverage that comes through sanction and other ideas, but working multilaterally with friends and allies in a peaceful manner. I believe that there, because if you think about it, war is ultimately a choice that people are making based on costs and benefits. And I think that they underappreciate the costs, the human costs, and all the second-order effects. And we're going through that right now. You think about our own country, you know, some of the bills that some of us are trying to advance. I'm working on something for Vietnam veterans, the Blue Water Navy, and some say, well, that's a big price tag. And, you know, my point to them is, well, you know, that's a decision you need to make up front. And if you think that way, get on my War Powers Reform Act, which really gets the American people back involved in the decision on use of force. But once you decide to send them in harm's way, you've got to take care of that veteran all the way through. So, you know, this is the whole point when it comes to how we approach the world, our foreign policy, which begets national security, which, of course, is a grand strategy in a sense, because everything is part of this. And that I argue that if we think differently, we will then be able to array our national security establishment. That includes the intelligence community, the DOD, and the Department of Homeland Security in a fashion. You'll reform it in a fashion that I believe will make us safer and cost less money.
I wanted to ask you, Vietnam War, the reason it ended, I believe, is because a lot of kids who didn't want to go and fight got busy and went on the streets and everything else. We haven't seen anything like it, really, since that time. Now, that led, of course, to, I believe, no draft. Do you think that was a good thing, not to have a draft?
Well, I'm torn about it, quite frankly, because I see where you're going in terms of what that does to the front-end decision on whether or not to use force. And look, I've given this a lot of thought and done a good amount of research on it. And because it came up, circa 06, 07, I'm talking 2006 and 2007 and 8. And, you know, and my point was that it didn't make any sense to go to a draft then because we could see, we could envision the end of operations in Iraq. And as we have, in fact, finished in Iraq, accomplishing limited objectives. And now we look towards Afghanistan, and I support what the president's doing here. We're in the final phase of our actions in Afghanistan to accomplish limited objectives. So, you know, going through a draft now would really not make any sense because by the time you'd go through the enterprise and you would bring these individuals into service and then train them, you'd be at a point that you'd want to be drawing down the size of a force. In fact, that's what's going on right now. The question on civil military relations as it occurs for the decision on use of force and as it impacts society, I think is one that we're going to continue to look at in the coming days and or coming years and decades.
I want to go to a new place on this, and I only have a few minutes, but I wondered if you talk about jobs in the economy and whether really we're in a cycle or whether there is something that a particular president could do.
Well, look, I mean, I think there's some basic blocking and tackling that needs to be done. And when you think about, and then there's the big idea. I want to talk about both. And I'm going to talk specifically about upstate New York. And I think it's very important to understand, you know, what we're good at and what makes sense for our area. And when you study it, you clearly see that agriculture is critical to our economy. That's a major driver for us, and we have some amazing, I'm biased. I think we got the smartest, hardest working farmers in the world. Their issue is profitability. So, you know, when I'm talking about economic development, we're talking with farmers and others, of course, but with farmers trying to ensure that the family farmers that we have right now, that they remain profitable. And there's a lot to learn there. We've got a farm bill we're working right now. And with dairy, what we learned is we brought forward a process that was based on the hundredweight price of milk in 2008, $16.94, and then we had a big crash in the price for the hundredweight down in some cases to $11, $12, and the support that we had, the safety net, wasn't adequate. So we're looking to learn from that in this current farm bill so that we have the right kind of safety net that ensures that we don't lose our dairy farmers. And then we also learned from the storm that we didn't have adequate crop insurance, particularly for our specialty specialty crop farmers.
You're talking about Irene.
And Lee. Yeah. And so we're working on that in the farm bill. And then the other piece I want to tell you is I'm very excited to tell you that I'm working with some young farmers in Dutchess County, Lindsay and Ben Shute and Hardy Roots Farm there, to try to help our next generation of farmers. So in terms of grants that help with starting farms, including veterans on farms, and then making sure we have the conservation programs that help, the Farmer Rancher Protection Program. So look, ag is very important. Tourism is very important. Small and medium-sized manufacturing, our contractors and building trades. I know we're getting short on time, but perhaps in the next section we can continue the conversation.